Tonight's shiur for the parsha of Vayechi. We begin with an experiment, investigation of a university in America that they decided to look into what's the perfect recipe, quote unquote, for becoming a millionaire. So what did they do? They picked 100 millionaires, and they picked students, and they attached each student to a millionaire, and to be by him, learn by him, see what he does, how he acts, what he does in his business dealings, etc., to see what's the recipe for becoming a millionaire. So the experiment was set out. Eventually, they found a very interesting thing. Out of the 100 millionaires, they found that 99 of them all had the same approach. What was their approach? Their approach was to be lethal. They were involved with this industrial spying and making sure that none of their secrets would be uncovered, and in very long drawn out lawsuits, and they're involved with McKinsey to try to destroy their competitors. That was 99 of these millionaires. That's what they were involved in. One of them was different. One of them didn't care less what their competitor is. He just did what he had to do. And he was very successful in doing so. He happened to have was an owner of a chain of pharmacies. So they decided, since he was different than all the rest, to interview him and find out what makes him tick. Why is he different? So they asked him. They said, "How come you're very calm and cool? You don't do what all the other millionaires do." He said, "I'll tell you the truth." He says, "When I started out, my father told me the following adage. He said to me, always remember, you have to set goals and achieve them at any cost. Whatever you got to do, you got to do it. Set your goals and do it. No matter what you have to do to do so, do it." And that was what I lived by. However, a few years ago, there's a group of managers, of CEOs, whatever, from companies, that we decided to go on a little trip to different countries and to see their cultures, the various cultures, and how they act, etc. So it'll help us in our business when we do business overseas and things. So we went from one country to another. And one of the stops, he says, was Israel. So we went Teal, see this part of the country, that part of the country. And it was very interesting. Then, towards the end of our trip, the madrich, the person that was taking us around, he said, "Now I'm going to take you to something fascinating. Places really fascinating." So they thought, it must be some archaeological dig or something. So our minivan heads towards Yerushalayim, and then we go and get into a neighborhood, and it's very crowded neighborhood with a lot of religious people. And he stops the car in front of a building, and before we get out, he says, "Let me ask you something." He asks us, the group. He says, "What in your estimation would have to be the size of an institution that would hold 4,000 students? A campus, for 4,000 students, quite a large populace. How big would you say the campus would have to be?" So they thought about it, and they said, "Probably about 130,000 square meters." So he said, "Okay, and how many staff members do you think such an institution would have to have?" I thought about it, I said, "Between 300 and 350. So he said, then he turned to them, he said, "Bruchim Abayim to the Mir Yeshiva." He says, "Yes, this institution has a student body of about 4,000 students, Yeshiva Bachur, And, however, the campus isn't 130,000 square meters. It's much less. It's 3,000 square meters. And staff members, there's no 300 to 350. There's 20 men at all, and that's it. And it's run by one person, and he's in charge of everything. He's in charge of accepting the students, and he's in charge of setting the, you know, what the students are going to learn, and the income of the place. He's in charge of everything. So he said, we heard this, we were astonished, we couldn't believe it. And then he took us for a little tour of the place. So we went to the various study halls, and no place to move. It was like sardines. Every little corner you see another couple of people learning together. Here and there, in the hallways and the thing. The place was jam-packed. That itself was interesting. But then came the highlight. When he said, now I'm going to take you to meet the person in charge, the Rosh Hashiva, he's called. And he said, don't be taken back, because you're going to see that he's physically, he's not so well. He has Parkinson's and other illnesses. And so, don't be shocked. So I said, okay. And sure enough, we came to the Rosh Hashiva's house. It was Nassim Tzvi Finkel, that's all. Simple, very simple home, table, chairs, nothing fancy. And we sat down, and even though it was very, very difficult for him to speak because of his illness, but he had this shining face. He took us in, with countenance, shining countenance. And we asked, we said, Kvod HaRav, we're all CEOs of these companies, etc., and we can't understand how do you run this institution? What's your secret over here? So many people stuffed into this one area, and everybody seems happy and busy and doing their thing. And how do you manage that? So the Rosh Hashiva said to them, he said, my dear friends, he said, let me ask you, what's the difference between a man and an animal? He said, I'll tell you. He says, an animal, when an animal wants something, it'll do whatever it can to achieve that thing, to get what it wants, even if it means to stepping on other things or or other animals, whatever it might be. That's an animal. Wants something, doesn't care, it does it. A human, on the other hand, he has the ability to mivater, to overlook his personal desires in order not to harm others. He can even take away from his own personal pleasures in order to give other people pleasure, to help them, whatever. So he concluded, he says, here in this yeshiva, people, they're human beings, live over here. And therefore, if everybody thinks about the guy next to him and how he can make him more comfortable and do good for him, it's no problem. You can have all these people living together very happily. So this person who's telling the story, this millionaire, says, when I saw this, when I heard this, I was like taken aback, because this totally went against everything I stood for. Then my father taught me to set the goals, and whatever you got to do, you can do it no matter what. And I realized that this is what animals do. I was acting like an animal. So I decided from that day on, I'm not going to hurt other people. I'm not going to step on other people. Totally the opposite. I'm going to look out for the good of others and not get into altercations with other people. I'm going to just do what I got to do. And let me tell you something. As you can see, I didn't lose out at all. Baruch Hashem, he didn't say Baruch Hashem, but he said I'm very successful in my business, even acting as a human being should act. That's the Maisa. And the reminds us of a famous word from Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, happened to be the Rosh Hashiva of the Mir, previous Rosh Hashiva, that used to say on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai recalled that he said that in his time, that six Talmidim used to cover themselves with one Talis and Osik B'Torah. So basically Rashi said, because they were very poor, so only had one talus, and they couldn't afford anymore, but they would still be Osek in Torah, fine. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz asked the Kasha. He says, how is it possible? He says, how could six people go under one talus, which is sack for one person? How is it humanly possible to do such a thing? So Rav Chaim used to say, he says, if everybody is pulling the talus for him, towards himself, I want the talus, no, I want the talus, then in a chanam, it's not enough, not one talus not being enough even for one person. However, if the six people are saying, here, you take the talus, no, you take the talus, then you can have six people standing under one talus. They say, in the Derech Drush, in the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, Omdim Tzfufim Mishtachim Revachim, one of the Nisim in the Beis HaMikdash, that even though people were standing like sardines, they were tzfuf, they were squished when they were standing in the Beis HaMikdash, but yet when it came time to Misvada, they used to bow down and have Revachim, they had plenty of room. So they say, Derech Drush, that Omdim, if a person is Omed, if he's standing on his principle, he's doing, only looks, cares for himself, then Safuf, then there's no room for anybody. But Mishtachavim, if you're bowing down to the other person, you say, here, let me help you, let me care for the other person, then Revachim, then there's plenty of room for everybody. Okay, let's move on to an interesting Shaila that came up. There was once a fellow Reuven who was looking for a shidduch for his son. So one day he was sitting on a bus, and in front of him, the seat right in front of him, happened to be a shadchan. How did he know? Because the shadchan, we'll call him Shimon, his phone rang, and he picked it up, and he could tell by the conversation, overheard the conversation, he was obviously a shadchan. Also, he understood that who was on the other side of the phone? A prospective client that wanted to, a man that wanted to find a shidduch for his daughter. So, Shimon the Shadchan is speaking out loud, you know, he's sitting this by, and so Reuven behind him is listening, and he's saying, oh, tell me about the girl, oh, she's this, she's that, whatever. And he's writing things down in his little pinkas, little pocketbook. He's writing down the various things. And Reuven's listening, and he says, wow. He says, this girl is really perfect for my son, from what I hear. So, what did he do? He was listening to everything. The only one thing wasn't clear was this girl a Sephardi or Ashkenazi, and that was important to him, you know, for the shidduch. So he taps the shadchan on the shoulder and he says, "Excuse me, sorry to interrupt. I couldn't help but overhearing. I see your shadchan. You didn't ask the other side, you know, that person you're speaking to, if they're Ashkenazi or Sephardi. Maybe you should ask them for your purposes." He goes, oh, thank you very much. Yeah, Doc, I forgot. So he says, whatever they answered, okay. And then it was mamish perfect for Reuven. And then at the end of the conversation, so the shadchan says to the man, can you give me your phone number? And he says, okay, yeah, what is it? 054. And he says it out loud, and he's writing it down. Fine. So, of course, Reuven jotted down the number as well. And as soon as he had the first opportunity, he contacted the other father of the girl and said, I have a son, whatever. And sure enough, they went out and they hit it off and they got engaged. So at the engagement party, the father of the girl said to Reuven, the father of the boy, how did you get to me? It's interesting. Well, you called me one day out of the blue. How do you know? Who'd you get? So he told him the truth. He said, I was sitting on the bus and the shadchan was in front. I told him the story. He says, really? He says, listen, I'm not so sure. Maybe we owe shadchanis money to this shadchan. Obviously, it was because of him that we got together. So maybe we have to pay him for being our shadchan. What do you say? Ruby says, I never thought of that. I didn't think, but who knows? So they went and they asked the shiloh. We spoke about this before, about paying a shadchan. Where does it come from? The source, Shulchan Aruch, Chosh Mishos, and Peizayin, and it's based on the din of in the Gemara of Yored Latoch Sadei Chavero, but not that a person goes into somebody's land and plants there, and benefits him, so you have to pay the person. So too, somebody who's an agent or a shadchan, he's doing something positive for you. Even if you didn't ask him for his services, you still have to pay him. So here, of course, they didn't ask this guy, this shadchan, for their services, but that's the question, maybe they still have to pay him. However, the psak that was given is that no, they don't have to. They don't have to pay him. Why? Because he didn't intend to make the shidduch. Right? He wasn't intending to hook these two people up altogether. It was only because he spoke out loud and thereby making Hefker the information, so that the father of the chassan, Reuven, picked it up. That's his problem. He doesn't get paid for that. He didn't make the shidduch. So that was the final outcome. And in fact, even though he was very pivotal in making the shidduch, but since that wasn't his content and he had no intent of making the shidduch, so therefore he doesn't get paid. Even though you might say, yeah, but Reuven asked him if he can clear up for him what, you know, nationality she's from or whatever, but that's, he's at a very, just a side point, that's not called making the shidduch, and therefore he doesn't really deserve to be paid. However, as a postscript, if the case would have been a little bit different, the outcome would be different as well. In other words, let's say Reuven didn't overhear, but he saw, let's say, the shadchan's little booklet lying around with information. And when Shimon the shadchan wasn't looking, Reuven went through the information and read it and said, oh wow, look at this, and took down all the information. That would be a different story. Because the information that's written in the shadchan's book, that's his own, that's his property, and nobody has a right to it. And if somebody takes it, he has to pay him for it. But here, in our case, that wasn't the case. He said out loud, he mafkered the information by speaking loudly, so that's his problem. If it would have been taken from what he had written without asking, then in fact, the shadchan would have to be paid. Next is a story, which we might have said before in earlier shirim. It's a beautiful story, so it's worth saying again. It starts with a terrorist attack that happened in Hebron. And an Arab appeared in one of the little side streets there, where there was a chayal, his name was Hananel, and he attacked the chayal, and he shot him at close range, wounding him seriously, and he was unconscious and bleeding and lying there. And as it happened, it was a street with very few people went. It was empty, so there's nobody walking by even, and he was basically bleeding to death. But as the nace happened, there happened to be one chayal who heard something, some shot, whatever, and he went looking around, and sure enough, he saw his fellow soldier lying there, wounded. So he quickly went up to him and did first aid, bandaged him up, whatever he could, called the ambulance, and he didn't end there. He cared so much for his fellow chayal that he said he's going with him. He went into the ambulance, went with him to the hospital, took care, you know, with the doctors and everything, made sure he was being taken care of properly, whatever, and one was just sat by his side. So eventually, they got through to the boy's parents, that they should come, obviously, to the hospital, and as soon as this chayal heard that the parents arrived in the hospital, he disappeared. You know, he didn't want to take any credit what he did. He just left. When he knew the parents were here, he doesn't have to be there anymore. The parents came, heard what happened, and the doctor said that there was a chayal here, you know, that Mamash literally saved his life. If he wouldn't have taken care of him when he did, he wouldn't be here right now. The parents said, well, who is this boy? They didn't know. They looked, they checked, couldn't find. Eventually, Ruch Shem, the boy, chayal, got better, he got released, and the parents did whatever they could to try to find out who was this chayal that saved his son's life, their son's life, but they couldn't find out. Now this, the family, they lived many, many years in a town called Kiryat Malachi. And they had a little makolet there, also for many, many years. So what they decided to do was to put up a sign in the front of their store, write what had happened, the story, and say that, and they wrote, if anybody has any information to help us find out who this boy is that saved our son's life, we'd be very appreciative if you can, you know, let us know. So he hung up the sign in the little store, front of the store, but nothing doing. Time went on, nobody commented, nobody knew anything, that was that. Only a year and a half later, this woman comes into the store, and she buys a few things, whatever. She leaves, and then as she's leaving, she noticed the sign, she reads it, and then she comes back in, and she's very emotional. Comes over to the lady that's in charge of the store, the owner, and she starts crying. And she says, "It was my son." He says, "It was my son. My son saved your son." She says, "Really?" He goes, "Yes, yes, I'm telling you, I know." She says, "How do you know?" She says, "Because I remember it was about a year and a half ago that our son came home and he was in the army, and he said, you know, when he told us exactly what he did, he was in the street, he saw this chayal injured, he did first aid, took him to the hospital, exactly what you described there on this on your sign over there. I'm sure of it, it was my son." So he said, "Oh, this is unbelievable." Anyways, however, that itself would be incredible, but the story doesn't end there. The woman, she called the store owner aside and says, "Listen, I want to tell you something else." "And what's that?" He says, "I'm sure you don't remember this, but this is not the first time that I've been in your store." She says, "I came to your store about 20 years ago. Came in to get something, and it was quiet, and you were behind the desk. So we started talking about this, about that, you know. And amongst the things we discussed, I told you at the time that I was pregnant. But I was having suffering a lot in my pregnancy. So I decided I wanted to abort the child, have an abortion. And when you heard that, you were shocked. And you said, 'No, you can't do that. Don't. It's terrible. And listen, you should have the child, and it's a big bracha, and this and that.' And you kept on and on how I have to have the child. And you know what? You made a big impression on me. And I decided after leaving your store 20 years ago that yes, I was going to have this child. And you know who that child was? That child was the boy that saved your son's life 20 years later. So here, you know, who would have ever thought that when you're trying to convince me to have this child, that this, you convinced me to have the child who's going to save your child's life." That's the lesson. The Kodesh Baruch Hu paid you back big time. Next, we have a maisa with a bacher. He's about 28 years old. And he got engaged, and things were going well until it got closer to the chasana. Just a couple of weeks before the chasana, this chasan got cold feet. Decided he didn't want to go through with it. So he went to his Rebbe, it was Rev Volbe, that's all at the time. And he said, "Listen, Rebbe, this whole shidduch, I was pressured into it. It's not for me, and I don't feel complete. I don't feel this is the right thing, and I don't have any emotional ties to this girl." On and on. So Rav Albi heard, and he said, "Listen, you want to cancel the shidduch? That's a very serious thing. You're talking about causing a big bizayon to this Bas Yisrael. And especially, you already set the date of the chasana. I mean, it's not like, this is very far along. It's almost the chasana. And it's a big bizayon to this girl. So it's not so simple. On the other hand, listen," he says, I don't know. "I can't force you to marry her either. Maybe you're right. Maybe she really isn't the right one. It's better to, you know, cancel it now and to get married." So he says, Rav Volbe said, "You know what? I think we better take this to a higher source." I think we should ask Rav Elyashiv what to do. So the Bacher agreed, and Rav Albe had a nephew, his name was Rav Benzion Cook Shlita. He was very close to Rav Elyashiv. So he contacted him. He says, "Listen, it's very urgent. You have to take this Bacher in to Rav Elyashiv." Fine. So he brought him in, told him the story, what he wanted, you know, dilemma. So how did Rabbi Yashiv comment? What was his reaction? He turned to the Bachar and he says, I have a question for you. He says, let's say you were to be told that this Kala is the only Kala in the world for you. And that's it. You know, it's, you marry her, you marry her. If you don't marry her, there's no other girl out there. Let's say there was such a thing. We could know such a thing. Okay, that this is this her or nobody else? Would you still cancel the shidduch and say, okay, even if there's nobody else, I'm not going to marry her, and well, what can I do? Nobody else. Or, oh, nobody else, okay. So, what would you do in such a situation? So the boy was honest. He says, Rebbe, listen, if this is, that was the case, if there was no other one, it would, this or that's it, I would marry her. So, Rabbi Yashiv said, you should realize that this is in fact the situation that you are in. As far as you're concerned, she says, there's no other one except for your fiance, besides this girl. So he said, why? So he said, because, as you know, it's aser to mevayish a bas Yisrael. And if you were to mevatel the shidduch, said that you'd be being mevayisher. And you know, he said, what's involved with embarrassing a Jewish girl. And therefore, he said, Memela, there is nobody else you have to marry except for her. And so it was. Finally, and with one last maisa, was a chassan and kala, just got married, freshly married, and their first Shabbos was their, of course, Shabbos Sheva Brachas. So they were going to be home for the Shabbos Sheva Brachas, you know, their own apartment, and the kala was very, very excited, because it was going to be the first time that she was going to light Shabbos candles. They're alone, you know, they have their own apartment now. And first time she just married, going to light Shabbos candles. So she was all excited. So she was getting dressed up and all prepared for this mitzvah the first time. And, oh, she was really, really excited for this. So, since she, with all her chanas, whatever, all her preparation, it was getting a little bit late. It's still time to light, but it's just getting a little bit late. And she went to the dining room, whatever, in order to light the candles. What happens? She gets there and she's in shock. What? She sees that the candles are lit. So she realized that since she was running a little bit late, her new husband, Hassan, said, oh, she's late. I don't know. I'll light the candles. And he lit the candles and he left for shul. And she was distraught. She was destroyed. She goes, how could he do such a thing? And I was looking so forward to lighting the Shabbos candle. And he goes there and lights it. Yeah, without telling me, without discussing with me. And, well, okay, I was running a little bit late, but big deal. He didn't have to do this. And it upset her tremendously. So much so that, you know, that Shabbos went out for the meal, for Shabbos brachos, whatever. She didn't talk to him. She didn't talk to him. She was so upset at him. How could he do such a thing? And, you know, he felt it as she was giving him the cold shoulder, you know, not talking to him, whatever. So then, okay, so he stopped talking to her. And very unpleasant situation, to say the least. Anyways, Motzei Shabbos rolls around, and she couldn't hold it in anymore. And he couldn't hold it in anymore either. And he approached her and said, excuse me, why did you give me the cold shoulder this Shabbos? What was wrong? I don't understand. Right? Just married, and what did it, what? She goes, how? What do you mean? You don't know what you did? She says to him. He says, did? What did I do? He says, how can you know? What do you mean? You don't play dumb. He says, what dumb? What did I do? She says, what do you mean? What did you do? I'll tell you what you did. How could you light the Shabbos candles when you know how much I was looking forward to doing such a thing? The first time I was doing the mitzvah of Shabbos, and you lit it. How could you do such a thing? She goes, I did what? She says, you lit the Shabbos candles. So he says, I lit the Shabbos candles? So he thought for a minute, and he says, oh, now I know. She goes, what? So he said, I'll tell you what happened. He said, I knew you wanted to like chunk out. So I went and I did what every good husband is supposed to do and prepared the Shabbos candles. You're supposed to prepare for your wife. In fact, it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, Siman Reish Samech Dalet, it's a Nagu Ladli Kaptila Lechabosa, Kedei Shetei Murchreches V'Tochaz Ba'or Yafeh. The part of the preparations for the candle, before they're lit, they should be lit previously and then blown out, because when the wick is a little bit scorched, it lights quicker and easier. And the Mishnah Berurah writes, V'zeh Yaseh Ish Mitchila. That's the job of the husband. He should light the Shabbos candles, blow them out, and then they'll be ready for the wife to light. It'll be easier for her to light. So that's what I did. But what happens? And now it hit me, he says. I lit the candles, and just as I was about to put them out, there was a knock on the door. I went to the door, I opened it, and it was an old friend of mine. And he said, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I missed your chasana, and he gave me a gift, and we started talking about this, about that. And then I said, oh boy, it's getting late, I better go to shul, and I ran out to shul, and I forgot to blow out the candles. So she saw that in fact, it wasn't that he was trying to be impolite, not at all, it was a total accident. He had meant to help her, and just forgot to blow out the candles. You see how a person can't and shouldn't jump to conclusion. And we just know a person has to damel chavschus, and it could have been a total different situation if she would have seen the candles lit and said, well, there must be a good explanation for this. I'm sure something happened, and first opportunity I'll discuss it with her. It would have been a whole different story instead of giving him the cold shoulder. And if we're done the chavschus, then we can be zocher, as the Gemara in Shabbos says, that danes chaver lechavschus, Kosh Baruch Hu Yadin Oso Lachavskus, Hashem will judge us, give us the benefit of the doubt, and mezake us in all our doings. We should be all zocha to the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu, Bimehir V'Yameinu.